To do, if it's all right with everyone,
I'm going to crack the windows just so that we have some airflow, if that's okay with you, because it gets very warm in here. And if anybody gets really, really cold, just motion to me and I'll shut them. But
just crack them. I'm not opening them full force. Check with you midway. Don't be bashful. Let me know if you get very. It's just us here. We're all friends. Okay. Okay, welcome to our third Morashah lecture. What we were looking at this month is a piece from the Kuzari, which was written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is 11th century, Spain. He has written. You will know his work. You might not know that it's his work, but if you know, through Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, there's a great deal of our piyutim, of the songs that we sing, the poems that we sing on Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, written by him. That he was a great poet. He was a master poet, but he was also a master scholar, and he was a great Talmid Chacham of Spain. And one of his most famous works is the Kuzari. And the Kuzari, as I wrote in my email to you when I sent out the text, which I'm not going to spend a great deal on now, I'm going to assume that you've read it. The Kuzari tells of a dialogue between the king of Kuzar and a rav, and a rabbi, who originally, the king of Kuzar, was concerned about, you know, religion, and which religion he was going to follow, and which he was going to ultimately bring his community and his community's country to follow. And he had debate and dialogue between a Christian, a Jew, and a Muslim, and ultimately he liked the Jew's presentation, and so he continues in dialogue with the Jew. And it's a dialectic, right? He discusses back and forth, he has questions, and the rabbi answers the questions. The one answering the questions behind the rabbi, of course, is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. He's the voice of both the king and the one who's answering the questions. Legend has it that the king ended up, after this discussion and dialectic, converting to Judaism along with his entire country. And the truth is, it's not so clear that that's fiction. There are many, many who hold that this actually happened sometime in history. But I'll leave it at that. That's really not the subject tonight. The subject tonight is one question, one issue that is raised by the king, which I didn't include in the text, because what was important to me was his answer. But the king's question essentially was, and it's a good one, he doesn't understand about graven images. We know it's not, you know, doesn't have to be a deep scholar to be able to know that the Torah does not approve of graven images. God says to us in the Torah, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Later on it says that includes graven images. Be careful. Don't pray to them. Don't bow down to them. Don't look at them as gods. And the king of the Kuzar has a problem with this, because he knows that the Ark of the Covenant has graven images right on top, very prominently. Golden cherubs, right? This is where cherub comes from in English. It's keruv, yeah? They call them cherubim, even in the singular. There's a cherubim, but it's really plural. Kerubim are plural, and a keruv is singular. So it's one keruv, two kerubim. And the kerubim are these childlike entities, right, that are on top of the ark. They have wings that arc and touch at the tips, and they are facing each other. Right, so the kerubim are facing each other, and they are. Our tradition is that one was male and one was female, but they were children, faces of children with wings, and this is at the top of the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is placed in the Sanctum Sanctorum, in the Kodesh Kodeshim, in the Holy of Holies, the holiest place on earth, as far as we're concerned. And so he finds it a bit of an issue, the king, saying, I get the whole thing about graven images, but I don't understand why you have this image, this graven image, jizz, too, on top of your holy ark in the most holy place of your sanctuary. How is that happening? What's the deal with that? And the truth of the matter is I didn't put this on the papers, but there's this very poignant discussion or a story told in the Talmud that when the Beit HaMikdash, the first Mikdash, was destroyed, The ark wasn't present, by the way, in the second Beit HaMikdash. There was no ark. We didn't have it because King Solomon hid it. That wasn't King Solomon, excuse me. Wasn't it King Solomon? It was Chizkiah, excuse me. Chizkiah HaMelech hides the ark in worry that it may fall into the wrong hands, right? And, you know, you can watch the Raiders of the Lost Ark and, you know, form your opinions. But the bottom line is that the tradition is that he hid this so that it couldn't be found. And by the second temple already, there is no ark in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Holy Temple. But in the destruction of the first temple, the Babylonians, it's again a tradition that we have, that what happened was is that they find this golden ark with male and female images, graven images, on top of it, and they say, look at this licentious people. They've kept it hidden all the time, and that really all they're interested in is the fornication of men and women, and this is what they've gotten gold on top of their ark, keeping it in the Holy of Holies. And so they looked at something that to us was very sanctified and holy as nothing more than pornography, which is quite upsetting and unfortunate, and tells you something about when things are seen out of context and when other overlays are put on things, how people see them. But the truth of the matter is it, once it was seen outside of our own personal context, it wasn't seen in a very good light. And so the king has a good question here. And what you've read is the answer to that question, right? The answer by the rabbi, here it's Rabbi Yehuda Levi, to that question. And essentially the answer, does anybody read it? Can somebody help me with this? How did you understand the answer to his question? I mean, I know you hate when I do this, but I'm doing it anyway. I'm sorry?
Nobody's worshiping.
Okay, that's a good point, but it's important to remember that the prohibition is not only on worship. We're not allowed to make it, have it in our home. I mean, there's actual contemporary discussions as to whether we can have full anatomically correct dolls in our homes because of this. So that's a good point, but it's not touching the prohibition. Does anybody else recall what it was? I mean, this is what I used to do in class. I would quickly read the text. Well, the teacher would ask. But did anybody read it back and have a sense of what the answer was over here? Anyone? Yes?
Yeah. With the graven images, I think was something that people chose to do without permission, whereas with the cherubim, that was we were given permission to do them. I mean,
precisely. That's exactly the answer, right? So what Rabbi Yehuda Levi answers, and this is going to be the focus of our discussion tonight, it seems like a very easy way out, yeah? And where he says, well, I mean, when we had permission and when we didn't. Because what happens is he says, right, one of the points that's made by the king of the Khuzar is, you know, the golden calf caused tremendous havoc. I mean, the response of God to that thing was just, you know, let's kill them all now. Which is literally, that's how God initially responds until Moses talks him down and says, listen, Kadosh Baruch Hu, Rebono Shel Olam, creator of the universe, do you really want to do this? Wait a minute, hold on, let's talk this through, and so on and so forth. Right? Golden image. And what he answers is, one was done without permission, and that was the golden calf, and one was done with permission. Not only was it with permission, it was a command. This is what's supposed to be done. You build this ark with golden images on top of it. The interesting thing is that these golden images actually are responsive to the golden calf because according to the majority of authorities, the Mishkan project, the project of building the tabernacle in the desert, was responsive to the golden calf. In other words, it was responsive to the need of the people to have tactile and sensible elements of divinity in their lives so that they could actually engage, because what they had, the catalyst to the golden calf was the people turning around 40 days, at least what they calculated to be 40 days of no Moses, suddenly saying, Ze Moshe ha'ish lo yadanu mehayano. We don't know whatever happened to Moses. So we'll make our own, you know, stand-in, because as long as Moses was around, he was at least an interface. I mean, they had a physical element, an individual that they could connect and have the go-between them and God. And so in order to be able to deal with that, they had decided to put something else in place, and that was the golden calf. They have none other than Aaron, Aharon HaKohen, the brother of Moses, to help them with this. Yeah, and so that is an indication. And he actually makes that indication over here. He makes the point, the Kuzari, that the very fact that they asked Aharon to help them shows that their original intention wasn't ill, right? It wasn't Excuse me, it wasn't a bad intention. You don't go to your teacher to ask him to help you do, you know, things that are mischievous. So what ends up happening is that the Mishkan comes to respond to the golden calf, and there is golden image that is included in the Mishkan. What's different about the golden image? One, it has a face of a human, although a child, instead of a calf. Remember, we're dealing with youth over here in both instances. It is not an adult bull, it is a calf. It is not adult humans on top of this, it is children. And so youth is a very important part of this. It's also, whereas the calf is male, the kiruvim are male and female. Right? So it's not an isolated element, it is a relational element. Right? There's relationship involved. So this responds to the problem of the golden calf, and the reason that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi gives is that one was done on their own, and one was done at the command of God, and that's all that matters. So we have to understand, why is it that that's all that matters? So let's first read his actual response together, and then we're going to discuss further. So he says, look, their sin was hatatam. I'm going to read from the Hebrew and give my own translation, even though there's translation listed. Hatatam hayta betziur asher neesar alehem v'shiyehasu inyan elahi el ma she'asu biyadam urtzonam mebili mitzvat ha'elohim. Their sin was that they made an image of their own hands, of their own volition, of their own permission, treated it as God without any input from God. They should have waited. They should have waited. This is talking about the golden calf, yeah? They should have waited before they made something that would have gotten them out into a bit of trouble, right? They would have found that, because what ends up happening is that although they had good intentions at the beginning, by the morning, they're already off the rails. Yeah, they're relating to this thing in inappropriate ways. The way that the psukim tell it, open it, is Vayakumu Ha'am Letzachek. They got up in the morning to play. Yeah, I mean, you know, the children, and they're playing with their toys. Umizbeach HaKorbanot. Im shelo hayta kavanat ha'am latzed me'avodat Elohim. Their original intention was not to leave the service of God. Ach hayu hoshvim she'em mishtadlim ba'avodah. They actually believed, this is very important, this line. They believed in what they were doing, that this was service. They chose to serve God in this way. So it's quite wholesome, the intention, at least at the onset. Very important. That line is very important. They were not, it's told very often that the whole project from its inception was ill-founded, and that there was malice and rebellion that was going on. It's quite the contrary. It wasn't rebellious at all. Al-ken, ba'wel Aharon. I mean, we can see that from the very fact that they went to Aharon and asked for his help. I mean, you wouldn't, that's the last guy you go to if you were trying to rebel. You don't go to the man's brother who's been, you know, partner in shepherding these people out to help them with rebellion. Aharon, hafez the galot matzpunam. And what did Aharon want to do? He wanted to be able to show their conscience, right? What was really on their conscience and what they were doing. Al-ken, see, yeah. He wanted to develop the fact that they had good intentions. They wanted to serve God, so he helps them out. What he ended up becoming guilty of was pulling out the ill intent from the potential into the actual. But we're just that they didn't have an ill intent. It was ill. And we're going to have to understand that even though they felt it to be positive, there were real problems here. Real problems here. And one of the ways that we see this, Harambam puts this out at the end of Hilchot Temura. What is Hilchot Temura? Very interesting set of halachot. There's a law in the Torah that was running in the days of the sacrifices when we would bring korbanot. And that was that if you offered or you set aside, already gave over an animal for sacrifice to the temple, and you wanted to replace that animal with another, you gave it. It was given. It was accepted. And you say, actually, I'd rather replace that one with another. Even if the animal that you want to replace it with is a better quality, higher grade animal, there's penalty for doing so. What's the penalty? Both the one that you gave and the one that you want to replace it with are now Kodesh. But you can't manipulate what was already given. So Harambam writes a beautiful thing. Actually, I'll read it for you. Because it's so good. I'm sorry I don't have it on the pages, but it's great. Never, my Rambam's never too far. Right. So it's the end of Hilchot Murah. He says as follows. He says, "Kol elu hadevarim." All of these things that we're talking about, where he says that if you give one and then you want to switch it, both of them become kodesh. Lachof Yisrael taken deotav. Why does the Torah do this? Why does the Torah penalize us in this way to say that it's not only the one that you gave, but the one that you want to replace it with? It's all to curb our drives. Curb our drives, yeah. Rov dinei Torah enayim etzot merachok migadol ha'etzah. All the laws of the Torah, actually, are all ideas, suggestions, so to speak, points from the Creator. Letaken ha'deot, to fix our interactions in the world. Uliyasher kol ha'asim, and to straighten our deeds. Why does he choose this to discuss this? The strange halakha, to discuss all of the Torah's things are there, to be able to deal with our drives, and to straighten out our deeds, and all of that. What's the problem? He says as follows. He says, look, here the Torah has gone down to the depths of our evil inclination. He says, why so? He says, because if a person wants, if you give a person permission, you give him permission to switch the poorer grade animal with a better grade animal, at the end of the day, he'll end up switching a better animal with a poorer animal. But the problem is that he will perceive his gift as though it's still his, and that he has strings attached. Did you give it? Or didn't you? Once it's given, it's given. You don't get to say what happens with it after you've given it. Once it's given, it has moved from your ownership to the ownership of the Mikdash and what we call Gavoah, which literally means the exalted or on high. Yeah? It is no longer ours. V'lefichach satama katuv, therefore the Pasuk simply said, you may not switch it. It's not yours to switch. Uknaso hriva amar v'ayahu t'morato ye kodesh. The one you gave and the one you want to switch it with is now both Kodesh. Don't play around. So it's saying to, why am I bringing this up? Yeah. Because what it says over here is that there are good intentions, good intentions, good intentions, good intentions, and Aharon brought out their bad intentions. Because at the end of the day, what was sublimated as what seemed on the surface to be quite good wasn't. What was running down underneath was personal need. And not genuine desire for service. Even if the personal need was service. Not to be underestimated. Not to be underestimated. This is a massive human drive. I mean, we see that human beings, even when they were isolated, develop these ideas of worshiping, sacrificing, taking their domesticated animals and offering them up to their gods. This is not something that is unique to the Jewish people, to the people that came before us in the cradle of civilization in the Middle East. This happens with the Mayans and the Aztecs. It's something innate. This is the same thing as a mouse bringing a cat bringing a mouse to its master. We bring our predatory drives into a sublimation. Sublimation means we take basic drives and raise them up into the more accepted or more sophisticated interactions of our humanity. And so if I'm engaging with God, I will take my hunter-gatherer drive and channel that to God, or the gods, or whatever it is that I serve. And if I'm a cat, it's my master. Look what I did. I got you a mouse. I mean, that's my accomplishment. There's problems with this. And this is how Harambam actually defines korbanot in the Moreh Nebuchim. He says the whole point of korbanot is in order to be able to allow for us channeling of basic primal drives to God. But don't think that we've grown out of that. If you're human and a mammal, you've got it. Nobody's grown out of that. It may be that you call yourself a vegetarian. That's fine. So you and your particular mode of expressing your particular humanity may have dealt with it. We as human beings in general have not dealt with this. As a matter of fact, we lost a great deal when we lost korbanot. We became less human when we lost korbanot. Because now we go and we treat our animals like units of food. It used to be that if you had a korban that the kohanim ate, you had to inspect every part of it. You had to know this animal. You had to have a relationship almost with this animal. You lived with the animals. They weren't some prepackaged cellophane wrapped, you know, styrofoam slab of meat that you forget is even once attached to a cow that we eat. Nobody sits down to their steak and says, "This is some good cow." As a matter of fact, we don't even want to know that it was cow. But that's not the way that it was. Hunters had great respect for their prey. Great respect for their prey. We lost all of that when we lost korbanot. So people think that it's barbaric, and so on and so forth, but that's a side point. I'm not getting further into that now. But there are primal drives. And one of the deepest, most profound of our primal drives is worship of deity. And so what Aharon was doing was trying to address that and give it a channel, because that's what he saw. But the problem was is that it wasn't an appropriate channel. And I need whoever is not muted to mute. It wasn't an appropriate channel. And the reason that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is suggesting that it wasn't an appropriate channel is very simple. It wasn't given by God. It was suggested by me. Now, whatever issues we have with that, we're going to touch on, right? Because I'm going to talk about, well, I mean, how does God do this, and why is that important, and is that a thing? But let's hold. So he brings out this bitterness, this problem with them. V'adavar ahu meruhak umgune etzlenu mibnei she'en bazman hazeh tzurot nevadot berov ha'umot v'haya kal bazmano. And what he says to the king is, it looks really outrageous to you, because in our days we don't worship this way. We don't worship this way, and we don't build golden idols and dance around them and sacrifice to them and so on and so forth. We're a little bit more sophisticated, or maybe a little bit more removed from that now. Only slightly. Right? Only slightly. He says, but let me frame it for you this way, which would be precisely the same thing. He says, what about building a synagogue? I mean, who said that you're allowed to do that? Where did that come from? Says, the truth is, let's say that their sin wasn't the golden calf. Their sin was that they built a house of worship that had not been commanded. They just needed a place to be able to bring their sacrifices. That wouldn't be such a big deal by us. We wouldn't look at that as such a serious thing. In their days, it was this equivalent of building a synagogue. I mean, you want to serve God, you make an idol. I mean, every Monday and Thursday, this is what you do. So think of it that way, says Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. ואפשר שנאמר שהשכינה חלה בהם והמלאכים חונים סביבותיהם ולולא הצורך להתחברות כעלינו, היה דבר הזה נכרי. He says, I mean, we go so far as to say God inhabits the place, the Spirit of God is there, it's holy, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's basically what they were saying about that thing. And the truth of the matter is, says Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, if we didn't logistically need an actual place for people to gather for prayer, we would have the same problem. Not that that answers our problem, but nonetheless, at least we have logistics that could be answered. If it wasn't for the fact that we needed that place logistically, we'd look at that as strange as the golden calf. In other words, we would look at building a synagogue that wasn't the Beit HaMikdash, that wasn't the holy temple commanded to us in the Torah or the tabernacle, as being foreign. I mean, where did we ever read anything like this? Where in the Torah does it say at all that synagogues should be erected in our places? It's like in the time of the kings of Israel. If you read through the book of Kings, right, there's one major problem that never goes away. Arises over and over and over and over again. And that is, everybody's building their own personal backyard barbecues to God. They're not sacrificing in the temple. They're doing their own personal sacrifices, and this is outlawed. So it will go so far as to say, and this king was a righteous king, and he did everything in the way of God and in the path of God. Rak habamot lo saru. The only problem was is that they kept using these personal sacrifices outside of the temple. Huge problem. Why is that different than a synagogue? It's not. That's what he's saying. It's serious problems. All right? So he says, "Hayu mochim ba'anashim ishtalim shayosim batim la'avodah, hayu nikraim ba'mot, hayu..." Of course, I mean, they would make, little shrines around these barbecues, you know. The greatest and most saintly of the kings would go around sending his people to destroy them. Could you imagine the king sending people out to destroy the synagogues? I mean, Henry VIII did this when he went Protestant. God forbid, Yeshua, you were a Catholic in that time. You know, I mean, everything was ripped apart. Of course, he took whatever he could, but I mean, that was... One day I'll tell you what I hold about that. I honestly believe that Henry VIII saved this country. That's all I'm saying. In any case, wasn't for him, there would be no Churchill. Notice that this was not strange in their eyes. It was matter of fact. It happened every day, everywhere, in every nation, everybody. This is the way that they worship. They made idols and they served them. And with that, even with that, as foreign, as non-foreign as it was to them, they were punished. Okay, so what is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi saying here? He's making a very strong point, saying it wasn't... He's trying to reduce the stigma of the graven image. We have been raised that graven image is idol worship. And there are certain things that we accept as idol worship and other things that we don't, because it's just a matter of the norm. And what he's saying is, don't look at the actual construct as what you judge to be worship or not worship, or idol worship or not idol worship. What has to be questioned is the source, not the construct. All constructs are problems. What do I mean by that? All constructs are problems. Anything, if we are talking about the service of God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, we are never talking about something that exists in our mind. If we're being truthful about it and real about it, we are talking about an external entity that does not depend on us, doesn't depend on me, doesn't depend on my approval, doesn't depend on my recognition, doesn't depend on anything. It is. If I happen to merit relationship with that great entity, then lovely, beautiful. It doesn't depend on my perception. So I dreamt that God would be forgiving is very nice, but that's your dream. It has nothing to do with God. One has to dream. Lovely. But God does not depend on my beliefs as to what He should, shouldn't be, is or isn't. So any... Now, if I take that a step further and I say, listen, as I've explained, I'm building on our previous discussions, okay? So even if you weren't at previous discussions, if you had read what I've sent, if you've read what I sent, then it shouldn't be completely far. The first thing that I sent was God, right? How do we understand God? We talked about primal existence. We talked about God being truth because He is essentially the necessary being. He is existence itself. And everything else is expressions of that being. So what I understand is that what I strive to do, and this we've discussed, in order to connect to God, is to try and approximate reality to the best of my ability. If instead of approximating reality, I am creating realities and projecting those realities out onto the world, I'm losing my connection, right? Now, everybody does this. It is part and parcel of being human. Our minds are illusion generators. It's the way that our brains work. And we forget this. We forget this. We believe that once I think something, it must be true. We rarely actually assume that anything that I think 90% of the time is untrue and that I have to test it. Because what I've got is a meat brain
that is developed from amoeba, if you go back far enough. It's really remarkable. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's one of the most remarkable systems ever to come out of the known universe. It is the most complex structure as far as the interconnections of its neural functions in the known universe by many orders of magnitude. It is one of the most, if not the most, remarkable elements, entities in the known universe. And it allows for the bodies that house this thing to be aware of themselves and to be aware of their own thought to the degree, and this is insane, I mean, this is craziness, to the degree that we can think about the way that we think and manage our thought by thinking about our thought. What do I mean? You do this all the time. We do this all the time, right? I'm sad. I realize I'm sad. I think about my sadness and contextualize it in order to be able to help pull myself out of my sadness, and therefore I can affect my own brain by thinking about the way that my own brain is functioning. Sometimes easier than others, but nonetheless, we can. So I've got this thing, and it's remarkable, and it's so powerful that I believe that it is infallible, because I think it must be true. Although nothing is further from the truth. It's not true that because I think it's true, it's only true that I think. And I hope that it's true, but if I'm responsible, I test what I think to make sure that it's true. As sure as I can be. And one of the worst ways to test it is with the people that think like me. And those are the people that I love the most. The ones who think like me. Because they connect to my emotions, not my thinking. I will much prefer to be accepted by those who are thinking and my thoughts coming in line with those who are thinking than my thoughts being true. In other words, I would rather be approved, my thinking be approved rather than correct. And that's all I need. And there's just tremendous elation that we have when people say, yes, he's quite right, quite right. Good show. We love that. We love that. Here. That's all one needs in order to be able to have validation. It's the worst way of validating one's thoughts. It's the surest way to make sure that your thoughts are never tested. But ultimately, it's the problem that we've all got. And so what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is saying is, we all project. Nobody is safe. No one is safe, not at any moment of any day. The question is, do I know that I project? Do I know that I am prone to projecting falsehoods onto reality? If I know that I am prone, and not because I am Joe Dweck, because I am a human, I am prone. Joe Dweck is an added problem. I do this more often than other people, right? But the bottom line, my wife tells me this all the time. Tell me all the time. Projecting. Yeah? The bottom line is, because I'm human, I will project falsehoods. If I am recognizing that I am prone to this, I will be interested, and I care about truth more than I care about being correct, then I will set my environment up in a way that I have testing going on. I will engage with those that don't think like me. I will set myself up internally to be able to hear critique. I will look for people that are smarter than me to be able to think about the ideas that I come up with and engage them. Peer review is an essential part of real, fundamental, bona fide thinking that we want to be true. So that's all over the place. Where does it go wrong? Where I project and then worship my projections. It's one thing to project. Everybody does that. It's another thing to hold on to the projections for dear life. It's a third thing and worst thing to not only project and not only hold on to them, but worship them. That is dangerous. That is where God says, I've had enough. I made them. I know how they project. But you don't bow and worship it and dance around it. So what we see when he's talking to Moshe, when God
is speaking to Moshe about this. It's the most amazing scene. It's coming up in a few weeks, right? Stay tuned. What ends up happening is God is in the middle of giving over the Ten Commandments to Moshe. I mean, you know, Cecil B. DeMille depicted this really nicely. You know, so you've got the fire, you know, blasting forth and printing the commandments on the tablets, and all of a sudden, you know, and the way that the Torah tells it is much more dramatic than DeMille, because God stops immediately. There's no graceful ending of his commandments, right? He stops immediately and in short, one-syllable words, says to Moshe, out, get out, down, leave. Lech, red. Moshe's like, what's going on? He goes, your people are corrupting themselves. But he elaborates. He says, they've made for themselves a graven image. Not yet the problem. What's the problem? Vaishtahavulo, vaizbehulo. They are bowing to it. They are sacrificing to it. They are saying, Ele Elohecha Israel, asher otziticha me'eretz Mitzrayim. These are your gods. This is your God, Israel, that has taken you out of Egypt. That's a whole other story. Moses comes down with the tablets. He sees the golden calf. He doesn't break the tablets until it says that he sees that they were dancing in circuits around it. Then he breaks the tablets. So this is closed circuit around their own visions and projections. That's the problem. There's no room for external input. So on one level, we haven't even gotten yet to the level of God's input. But on one level, the severity of this problem is that it became impervious for external input. And that's one basic level that we have to question. We don't have to be 3,000 years ago in sandals and in the desert with a golden image in order to be able to be practicing the same behavior. That's his point over here. We do this with synagogues, potentially. I mean, all we need is, of course I'm going to build a synagogue, but as long as my name is, you know, up and really, you know, in broad letters. Okay, no, nobody said you shouldn't have your name, but the bottom line is, what's the motive for building it? Why am I doing this? What are the... All right, so if I create situations in my life in where I set myself up to be impervious to external input, then all I'm interested in is my vision and my projection and those who are buying into my vision. And that's a very dangerous system for living. It is sure to die because it's suffocated. It suffocates itself from any lifelines that can come in from the outside to be able to sustain it. And it's true that there will be entities like this that will sustain themselves in any number of ways for a time. It's just artificial life. Money's great with this. Money works very well for artificial sustaining. As long as you've got it, you know, you can pump money into things, and it'll stay artificially functioning, even though their viability has gone away long ago, in order for it to be able to last and function on its own. So these are all very local questions to us. These are very, very personal, tangible, relevant questions to us. But Rabbi Yehuda says one other thing, as we've heard, and that is, it's not just that they were impervious. There was no communication from God. All right. So this is where it gets a little bit difficult, because we have to understand this: no communication from God. And here is really where the crux of the of our lecture tonight is found. What I want to do is consider the following. I don't want to posit prophecy from a logical perspective. What do I mean by that? I'm talking about the actual function of prophecy, the actual mechanism of prophecy. It's not something necessarily that we can discuss in rational terms. What I want to do is I want to present why prophecy is an essential component of Judaism, certainly Orthodox Judaism, and why, without it, We are talking about something very, very different. Are we okay with temperature? We okay? Okay. Back to our meat brains. Okay. As remarkable as they are, even if we can ascertain that the reality that I am detecting is genuinely true, forget it for a minute about projections. Let's go one level up. Okay, we've gotten to a higher level. I'm not so prone, because of the safeguards that I've put into my system of thought, to failure, imagination, falsehood. I've set up systems where, more often than not, I am able to ascertain the nature of reality. Okay. How am I doing this? Could be the scientific method, could be, you know, the laws of logic, whatever it is, rules of logic, however it is. Okay. Now, we know that even in terms of the rules of logic, and in terms of the scientific method, we are handicapped. Why are we handicapped? Because all I've got to ascertain anything is the meat brain. It's all I've got. I have absolutely no alternative. Yes? You don't have to think about this. There's nothing else that you can think about with. It's what you've got to think with. So that's all you've got. Right? It's all any of us have. The most brilliant minds... That's all they've got. They have one that's like working on optimum levels. Doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it isn't anything other than a brain that has evolved from within this planet. Responsive to stimuli. Guided by God. Fine. But it's still of this planet. It is of this earth. It is remarkable. It is unbelievable. But it also can only detect what it can detect. So, for example, you cannot perceive anything that isn't physical. You just can't, no matter what it is. Want to think of something that is spiritual, whatever it is that you're thinking is physical. Whatever you imagine it to be, it's physical. I mean, I used to do this with the kids in school. I would ask them, okay, you know, what does a soul look like, or, you know, God, or anything. It was always a class. I mean, the most ethereal, you know, was light, which is as physical as you can get. Right? And that's why we use light, to talk about things that are light, as opposed to heavy, you know. But it's still physical. And as a matter of fact, we only detect one small element of the spectrum, don't we? We only hear a small element of the wave system. And that's because it's all we're set up to be able to ascertain. We only have certain receptors that are able to pick up certain elements. So we've built other receptors in order to be able to know that we're only picking up parts of it on our own, because we have other things that are able to pick up the other parts. So we've got X-ray machines, you know, that we can't, you know. But at the end of the day, we're making the machines. This is our machine. It comes from our brain. We have no way out. There's no way out. We're stuck. So all I can ever see, feel, sense, think is what my brain can think. And there are limits to the human brain. The minute I start talking to you about four dimensions instead of three, we're at the edges. What does that even mean? We've got physicists talking about 10. Theoretically, nobody's ever seen an electron. You know this. No one has ever seen an electron. We just assume that they're there because they work with the mathematics. That's all. And we tend to test for them, and they tend to work with our testings and so on. Okay, wonderful. Nobody's ever seen one. Nobody will ever see one. We don't have the mechanisms with which to be able to pick them up. We forget this. Because we're so brilliant in our own eyes, and we are, but in our own eyes, because we have no other eyes, and nor do we have any other brains to detect what it is that our eyes see, we forget that we are severely handicapped, even in terms of our capacity to detect the natural world. Forget about reality. And when I say reality, I say if there is, what there is, at any in any capacity beyond our natural world. We have no way of knowing one way or another. At least in terms of our physical human senses. I mean, even our logic. Think about our logic. Our logic is based on whatever we know the world to work. You know, how we know the world to work. So one thing can't be in two places at the same time. It's quite logical. We know that because on this planet, in this universe, one thing can't be in two places at the same time. Unless, of course, it's an electron. And then it's in all places at the same time. Virtually. Relatively. Statistically speaking. Until, of course, you look at it and then you collapse the wave function and then all of a sudden it's just where it is. And I guess it'd be really annoying. I mean, it's really, really unfortunate because then we question, well, I mean, is there any reality without my actual examining of the reality? Because if the electrons that form the entirety of my world, and they're not alone, I mean, you've got all other things, but, you know, they're part of it, that form my whole world are really virtual particles and that they essentially are manifest in every single possible permutation, and that the only time that they hold a particular space is when they are observed, which is what we found out, whatever that means, right? That means that this room doesn't exist until I look at it, basically. At least not in the way that I perceive it. So we've got problems. Because forget about the question of illusion. All I ever have is my brain. What I'm a cocoon. I'm locked inside myself. I never see anybody. What you are seeing is simply light. You hope, anyway. You hope you're not hallucinating this entire thing. I mean, you wouldn't know, really. Because all that's happening when one hallucinates is that the brain is firing as though it is being stimulated by an external image. And what's an external image? It's light bouncing off something that is running into your light sensor that is being detected by your rods and cones, and your brain is seeing this thing. It's funny because we say, and my brain tells me, right? Your brain doesn't tell you anything. It's just there. It's what is. Upside down, right side up, whatever the case may be. We never touch anything. I mean, I have nerves at the end of my fingers that help me to be able to detect what I hope is a stimulus, an actual external stimulus that is being detected because it's there. But don't think that there aren't tactile hallucinations. You ever see the movie Ray? Stop it. Seriously? Come on. Really? Ray. Ray Charles, Ray. Okay, well, go do that. And one of the problems that he had because he was blind was that he had tactile hallucinations. His brother drowned when he was a child. And this haunted him his entire life. And he would imagine that water was filling the room and coming up over his leg, his feet, his legs, his knees. He felt water. He was blind, but that was his hallucination. And all that was going on was that his brain was feeling what wasn't there. It was firing in the way that it would were there a stimulus without the stimulus. Phantom limbs that people talk about, right? If a person has to have an amputation, they're feeling, I mean, how do you deal with that pain? Or how do you deal with that feeling? I mean, it's not there, so how is it supposed to be treated? It's all in the brain. This tells us about the power of placebo. I mean, till today, they're testing drugs with placebo. If I want to test a drug and see how it functions, yeah? So I've got the drug, I've got placebo, and then I've got nothing. And I see what's going on. Why am I testing with placebo? Because I want to know. I mean, is there some external actual function that's going on over here chemically, or is it all in your head? And then you look, I mean, don't sell it short. Your head's pretty powerful when it comes to healing things. It just matters how long, how much you believe in it, that's all. I mean, seriously. So what's my point? My point is that we are hopelessly locked into our minds. And that means that if God is a reality, which we are taking as our axiom, as our postulate, there's no way for me to connect to Him. Because all I've ever got is my brain. And I have no idea how I should connect with God. Because God has no thing that is in comparison with me. So, for example, The same is relatively true with me and any other human being. I have absolutely no idea, really, how any other human being sees things, feels things, senses things, thinks of things. I never get out of my own head. All I can really do is extrapolate from my feelings and hope that the human that is somewhat like me on the other side is experiencing things in some manner like mine. Of course, we understand that that's helpful only in a very limited sense. Because as our faces are different, our minds are different, and the ways that we experience things are profoundly different. So the humor that works in one country just doesn't work in another country. You just don't think that way. And the experience of pleasure that one particular individual will experience as pleasurable will not be experienced as pleasurable for others. And should I open the windows or not? It's really as simple as that. So if that's the case with the human beings that for all intents and purposes are built more the same than different, when we're talking about God, in which we have absolutely no comparison, how am I supposed to assume that whatever it is that I think should be done to connect to God is A, genuinely connecting me to God, and B, something that God's interested in, quote unquote? So of course you could always say there's the thing about the kid making you the art project in school that looks uglier than the ugliest thing that you've ever seen. But since he made it, you love it. Fine, so there's that. But that's very elementary. Because once relationships start happening and you get the wrong gift, it tells much more than just the thought that counted. Because the question is, well, really, what were you thinking? I mean, this happens in relationships. You get the gift for the birthday or the anniversary. But, you know, the power saw was just not what I was interested in, you know. I mean, yes, you thought about my birthday, but you thought about my birthday entirely in your own terms. That's not relationship building. And if nobody's experienced this, I'm sorry, I have many times. It is the thought that counts if the thought is relationship oriented. But if the thought is selfish or self-centered, then it doesn't really matter, because all it means is that you really don't know me, do you? And what the gift says to me is, this is affirming that I don't know you. And that's a serious problem. So children is one thing. We don't expect that children should have the capacity to be able to be sensitive to another and question, what will I do that will make you feel? It is more, I'm going to show you that I thought, and that's it. Okay, on a certain level, it's acceptable. But it gets to a point where it's not acceptable anymore. And the truth is, we were engaged in idol worship for a very long time. And there were levels of idol worship that we even tolerated. But once we got into covenant with God, it was, this is off limits. This is the worst thing that you could possibly do. Okay, so what's the answer? Well, that's the problem. At least in terms of our religion and our devotion and dedication to God, we are not saying that we've got the answer. We insist that part of the corpus or the belief system of our people is we need input. And that's where prophecy comes in. It is why Maimonides makes prophecy one of his 13 key core beliefs. Because if I don't have it, it's just a different religion. And I know that that's a very severe and harsh thing to say, but I'm not saying it politically, I'm saying it logically. It's why, as far as the Sfaradim are concerned, our level of religiosity may have been questioned, may have been various levels, but we didn't question the principles. Today, it may not be true with every individual, but in terms of our system, in terms of the Sfaradim in general, we didn't question your observance. We may have encouraged a better observance, stronger observance, motivated towards greater fear of heaven, and so on and so forth. But the people didn't question the core belief system. It was either I can afford it or I can't afford it. I'm willing to invest in this much, not this much. But the belief system was the belief system. And part of the belief system, which we sing about every single Shabbat in the Igdal and in the Adon Olam, and we say it in every prayer, is that prophecy is a thing. And the reason we need it, it's essential to us, is because without input, we have absolutely no way out and no mechanism for connection. It is why we look at Torah as being prophecy. And if it isn't prophecy, the value of it gets tossed right out the window. It's not, it is not, it's also a really good book. Because if you think about it, without prophecy, it's really not a very good book. Now, this is important to understand. If this is not a communication from the outside in, from God in, telling me, this is how you can connect. I'm telling you, as existence itself, to you the expression of existence, who has no way out of your meat brain, that this is a manner in which you and your little planet over there, revolving around that one little star, that to me is, you know, one of trillions and trillions and trillions, and who knows how many others there are out there, really not important for us. But the bottom line is that this communication is for you. You can use your, what are those things you guys have down there, those four-legged creatures? Yes, your animals, yes. You can use those. You'll use this one, and this one, and this way, and this way, and this way. This is the way that it can be done. That can connect you out. Now, there are going to be some things that will be quite sensible to you, and some things may not be very sensible to you, and those are the issues, right? The things that aren't sensible to you, all right, you don't have to sense everything, nor do you have to understand everything. I'm telling you, this is the way that the world works, and it will function for you in this manner. That shouldn't be so strange to us. That shouldn't be so strange to us, because the majority of what we've discovered about the world, we actually had absolutely no sense of it and its reality whatsoever. My favorite example is the sun itself. I mean, we still talk about it incorrectly in our prayers and in our everyday vernacular. We talk about sunsets. The sun doesn't set. The sun doesn't move. I mean, it moves in its grand way, but it certainly doesn't move with relation to how it is that we think it does. The sun's not going anywhere. We are. You know, it's like when you're sitting in the train and the train next to you, you know, is moving and you think you're moving but not sure you're moving, and they read, wait a minute, am I moving or is that train moving? You know what I'm talking about. Yeah? Your mind plays tricks on you. And that's what happened with us on the planet. We kept looking out and seeing the sun moving all over the place, and we thought that the sun moved all the time. We thought the sun moved until yesterday. And then all of a sudden we kind of thought, we jailed the man and killed him, basically, for maybe, we're the ones moving. Now, he's the heretic for suggesting this, Galileo and Copernicus and so on. But it's what it looked like. As far as our senses were concerned, that's the way that it was. And we still will call it a sunset rather than an earth rise. I mean, no one wants to talk about an earth rise. Do you see that beautiful earth rising tonight? It just doesn't have the same romantic ring to it, you know what I'm saying? So I'm just going to end this point and I'll hear the question. There are things we don't understand about reality. That's not the problem. But if the Torah is not prophecy, then we've got a book that, you know, roughly 50% of it, if not more, is completely irrelevant to our lives. And that's a thing. It's also a different religion. We can call it Judaism, but it's not the same. It's one thing to address law. It's another thing to say that the entire corpus of prophecy, the entire concept of prophecy, is not what it is. And all I'm saying is, the reason we hold that it is because we realize that otherwise, we don't have our cake and eat it too. You cannot not have prophecy and connect to God. You cannot do it. Nobody can. And if you do, it's incidental. It's as simple as that. So what we say is, yes, we believe, absolutely, that it is prophetic. And it's not just prophetic, you know, inspired by God. Dictated word of God. The written law. Our application of that law, our adjudication of that law, our questions of the meaning, and so on of the law. Okay, that's part of what the oral law is, and that's given into our hands, and that's the way that it was meant to be addressed. But at the end of the day, we do not realize, but the truth is, if I don't have input from the outside, I have no way, none, to connect to God. None. I need the input. I need the communication. I need to hear how it is that I am supposed to connect. It's the way it is with human beings for the most part. All the more so with an entity that is completely and utterly different from what we are. So I want to read something for you. And before I do, I'll hear the question. Did you have a question?
Yes. You were talking about the problems with idol worship in Judaism.
Yeah.
How our needs as humans to relate to idols and how can we communicate. Mm. But lots of other religions in the world have lots of idols and they never have any problem with it.
Right.
And why do you think that they don't have a problem with it? How
I'm saying, I mean, listen. How do I do this in the most politically correct way? Yeah, so the question is this point recognized or not? So it's interesting. You know, other religions will say, look, we don't negate prophecy. We just say that prophecy happened again. And that's a different question, right? Did prophecy happen again? And in what capacity? And how? And so on and so forth? That's a different question. But they understand and realize at least that they can't negate prophecy. Because if they do, they've got nothing. It's the reason why the Pope is infallible. I mean, if you don't have a line to God, you know, you've got no, what are you doing? So you've got some man that's dressed up really nicely or whatever you have you with, you know, doing what he thinks. It's a problem. So we are very, very limited with regards to our perceptions of prophecy. And there's a reason why we say that we don't believe it's happening anymore. Officially, I mean, this is official doctrine, right? It's not happening anymore. Everything that God needed to say has been said. No more needs to be said. Look into it. That's the way that we deal with it. I'm not going to deal with the whole elements of prophecy tonight only because I don't have time. I'd be happy to continue it, right? We can look at this and unpack it more. All I'm presenting tonight is that point. Without it, all we've got is ourselves. There is no way out. Full stop. End of story. No way out. We can have our cake and eat it too if we want to and pretend like we're having it, but that's the whole point. It's pretend. There's no reality to it. So that's why I'm going to show you. First thing that I want to look at on our papers is at the top, the paragraph that is only in Hebrew. The Rambam writes that of the 13 principles of faith, the sixth of the principles is prophecy, and this is why. I cannot have Judaism without it. I can't have Torah and relationship with God without it. And that's, by the way, the point of the 13 principles. If I don't have the 13 principles, I don't have Judaism and Torah. I've got something else that may resemble it, that may sound, feel, sensibly relate to it. But isn't it? So these 13 things are what define the nature of Israel, the people of Israel, and not as far as the Rambam is concerned. And I'm explaining why. Because without them, they're not just ideas of belief. These are core logistical elements without which I've got a completely different system running. And that's why the Yigdal is so important for us, why we end our prayers with it every single time, right? And it's included in the Adon Olam. That's what we do. I mean, we reaffirm over and over. This is what it's about. The levels of my observance and so on, that's between me and God, or between me and the Beit Din, or between whatever the case may be. But I am a member of Israel, either rebelling or not rebelling, doing properly or not properly, but I'm within the corpus because I recognize these are the underpinnings. So the sixth principle is prophecy. And he writes, who, what is it? Ladat shezeh hamin ha'enoshi, that this species that we call human, says Maimonides, yesh yimanzu bo ishim ba'alei kishronot mefutachim me'od v'shlemot gedola, there are among them those that reach very high levels of perfection and integrity, V'tit konen nafsham, and their souls get to a point, ad shemekabelet tzurat ha-sechil, to the point that they have great level of intellect and awareness and consciousness. V'yithaber oto ha-sechil ha-nashi b'sechil ha-poel, v'yatzel alehem imenu atzilut shefa. And through that, they have a capacity to open themselves for communication from God. Right? So in other places, the Rambam says, not anybody can be a prophet. I mean, you have to be an appropriate vessel to be able to receive that kind of communication. It goes through a whole bunch of stuff. But in any case, he's saying that this is a fundamental principle. And that we get information. Zoya Nivua, this is what we call prophecy. There is external communication in to the prophet. If I were to explain this in its fullness, it would be take a long time, says Maimonides, a very, very long time, which he ends up doing in his Guide for the Perplexed. He goes through an entire section. It's three sections, the Guide for the Perplexed. And the second section deals entirely with all of the components of prophecy and how we see it logistically, not just in terms of our belief. In other words, if we are going to, basically what he says in the Guide to the Perplexed, if we are going to accept prophecy and understand it, it must carry these components. Otherwise, it's a farce. Right? So he gets to that degree. Right? The other thing that I want to look at, which is the second thing on the backside of the paper, which is translated, is his opening to the laws of Avodah Zarah, of idol worship. And what he does at the opening of the laws of Avodah Zarah is he tells the story of the development of Avodah Zarah, at least in terms of his understanding of it. And a main character of this story is Abraham Avinu, is Abraham. Because the whole thing for us about Abraham Avinu is that he pulled himself out of idol worship by discovering God on his own, through his own deductions. So here, this snippet, he says, what happened with Abraham once he discovered God? He says, look, Kevan shehikir v'yada, hitchil lehashiv tshuvot al b'nei Ur Kasdim. He started to debate with the people in Ur Kasdim. This is our tradition, right? This is what Abraham did. He started to debate with them, saying, listen, I mean, you know, I hear what you're saying, but let me ask you, you know, does it really hold water? And he would sit and have these debate, logical debates with them. He would say, listen, you're not thinking truthfully. He went around and started shattering idols, both theoretically and physically. You know, people think that Abraham Avinu was this nice, you know, old grandfatherly type person. He was an iconoclast. I mean, our tradition is that he was thrown in jail. He was a freedom fighter. He didn't put up with any of this, you know. Later on, you know, we have the more grandfatherly image of Avraham Avinu, but Avraham was not a man that took things sitting down. He was a very, very in-your-face type of person and insisted that truth should be asserted. And so he went out and tried to get, you know, this eradicate this from his neighborhood and his environment. And he would say to them, "En," listen to this, "En ra'ui la'avod ela le'eloa ha'olam." It is unfitting to serve, this was his first point, anything other than primal existence, the God of the world. So that was his first argument, right? Stop serving sub-elements. Serve the ultimate entity. And then he said, "Velo ra'ui," and it is to that entity that is fitting, "lishtahavot ulhakriv ulnasech." It is to that entity that is appropriate. If you're going to bow, bow to that entity, to the Holy One. If you're going to pour libations in your service, do it to that entity. If you're going to sacrifice, to that entity. Now, it's very important to recognize over here that the way that he's saying this, Abraham, right? The way that he's saying this to people is, it is unfitting to do what you're doing to anything other than capital G-O-D. That's his point. Does he create a religion? No. Does he institute service? No. Does he suggest how it is that we should serve God? No. Which is an astonishing thing when you think about it, because it would be the next logical step. You found God, now let's serve Him. But it's not what he says. He just says it's not fitting to bow to anything other than that God.
It's not fitting to pour libations to anything other than that God. But he doesn't say, all right, everyone, let's get together now. We are now going to serve the one and only true God. And this is how we're going to do it. That doesn't happen to Abraham. And the reason it doesn't happen for Abraham is because he spends his entire life trying to stop that kind of behavior. What he's not interested in is the projections. Stop with the projections as far as Abraham is concerned. If you're going to do something, do it to the right God. But I don't know what he wants, and I don't know what it is that I'm supposed to do. And we find, as far as Abraham is concerned, read the story. The only time he does anything is when there's direct communication. And count the times that God speaks to Abraham. We think God's talking to Abraham throughout his entire life. You know, he had a handful of times throughout his entire life. Over a century, supposedly, he's living. Nothing was done until there was direct command. So Harambam continues this dialogue, and by the end of the halachot he writes, and I'll read it for you, because it's a great one. By the end of the introduction to Avodah Zarah, he says, since we have this problem of not knowing what to do, and we're not going to be brazen enough to start creating things and assuming what it is that we should do, we need information on the from the outside. So therefore, me'ahavat Adonai otanu, from the love that God had for us, umishomrot shivua le'Avraham avinu, and from keeping the swear, the oath that he made with Avraham our forefather, asa Moshe Rabbeinu, he made Moshe, our master, Rabban shel kol ha'nevi'im, and this is why he calls him that here, the master of all prophets. He's the top prophet. There's nobody that prophet, right? That's why we say, Lo kam b'Yisrael kemoshe. Yeah? Yeah? All right? So, how does it go in the Yigdal? How does it go? If I'm not singing it, I forget.
Did you?
How does it? Right? There was no Navi, no prophet came up like Moshe ever again. And so that's borrowing from the line of the Torah. So he sends Moshe, and once Moshe had prophecy, Ubahar Adonai b'Yisrael nachala, and God chose Israel as his people, Hichtiran b'mitzvot, he crowned them with commandments. V'hodi'an derech avodato, and he communicated to them the way that he should be served. So this is a response to the problem. In other words, the way that the Rambam is looking at the whole of Torah mitzvot is a response to this problem. No, I know that there's no way for you to connect to me. No, I understand that there's no possible way for you to get out. And so I'm sticking my hand in, and I'm telling you, this is the way. And therefore, what would be the judgment? And what happens when people serve in foreign manner? And that's why there's really only two things. There's either avodah or avodah zarah. There's either service or foreign service. But there's nothing else. So it's either what has been prescribed or it's what I decide. And that's his point in saying, who said I can build a synagogue? That was when Rabbi Yehuda says, who said we should build a synagogue? That's a serious problem. It's not a small problem. We're not like kind of saying, okay, no, I get it. No, this is a real problem. And what he's saying is, if it wasn't for the logistical fact that I just need coordinates within which to gather people to keep them safe from, you know, the elements outside, I'm not allowed to do that either. And that's why we've got to be very careful when we actually do build them. And we actually do engage in them, and how it is that we manifest, and so on and so forth. To what degree am I projecting, and to what degree am I recognizing this as a mitzvah? And that's why the whole question of foreign worship is really alive and well. Because as he says, it has nothing to do with the golden image. Yes, we've got a golden image in the sanctum sanctorum, atop the Ark of the Covenant. Not an issue. It's part of the command. There's nothing particularly wrong with a graven image. It's only a problem when it's your mode of trying to connect to God without any input from God. But once there's input from God, fine. So, of course, there are many questions. I'm happy to hear them.
But this I'm putting out as a principle, so that we can understand, A, why it is that we hold the Torah as prophecy from God. Why we talk about Moshe's prophecy as being this way. What it means not to. What it means to say, I don't accept, or it's not something that I hold. No one can force anyone, right? But why to us it is an essential core of what it is that our Torah is about, our Judaism is about, and ultimately our lives are built on. Without it, it's just something entirely different. It's something that we wrote, came from our heads, okay, I mean, go to the library. It's just a completely different entity entirely. So here I put to end Alan Jacobs, who wrote this book, How to Think, and the subtitle is A Guide to the Perplexed. But it's a great book. It's a very small book. I recommend it. And in this book, he essentially writes about thought. So if you want to read the real work on thought, read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. But it's not an easy book to get through. Thank God I did, but it's a perilous journey. And what he says over here is very one point. He says, human beings are not built to be indifferent to the waves and pulses of their social world. For most of us, the question is whether we can have even the slightest reluctance to drift along with the flow. Can we pull away from the flow even a touch? The person who genuinely wants to think will have to develop strategies for recognizing the subtlest of social pressures, confronting the pull of the in-group and disgust for the out-group. The person who wants to think will have to practice patience and master fear. And that's just the level before prophecy. That's just the level of maintaining reality. All right.